Henry II of England and his wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, have created and ruled the Plantagenet Empire, the most dynamic, wealthiest, and most powerful kingdom in Western Europe. But the Plantagenets are rarely at peace, and Henry's temper and ego has long troubled his family and his people, from the shocking martyrdom of Thomas Becket to the vicious Great Rebellion that saw Eleanor sent to prison for 15 years. Meanwhile, their brilliant, avaricious, rebellious children have grown, fought, ruled, married, and even died, so that of his five sons, only two survive, Richard Lionheart and John Lackland. Now, as the 12th century enters its final decade, Henry himself dies, leaving his great legacy poised at the edge of great success or great failure. Here's the story of what happens as Richard and John take their turns on the Plantagenet throne.
Welcome back to season 3 of Lion's Forge. My name is Becket, and I want to tell you a story, an epic true story of five kings and the Lion Queen. Season 3, Episode 8, So Much Left to Fate. Treason might be simmering back in England, but Richard took little, if any, note of those distant prospects. Saladin was of vastly greater importance, and Lionheart realized he would have his hands full. There was an eclipse of the sun, always a worrisome omen of heavenly displeasure. Just as his captains had feared before they left Europe, he got sick, possibly suffering from some kind of influenza. Knights reportedly had to carry him on cushions to reconnoiter Acre's battlefield, but neither illness nor solar eclipse slowed him all that much. He went about the business of the crusade, placing his newly delivered siege machines all around Acre's walls. Frank McLinn, who greatly admires Lionheart, believes that Richard's skill with siege equipment at Acre was remarkable for its originality, both in terms of the equipment's design and use. His counterweight machines and traction engines were much more effective than traditional siege machines. Richard took his engines closer to the walls than earlier leaders had done. It means that his men were much more vulnerable to missile fire from Acre's walls, and it's a true tribute to his leadership that his men were prepared to follow him there. He also confidently sent emissaries to Saladin to propose a meeting. Saladin famously replied that kings could not meet until envoys had thoroughly probed the direction of their talks, since once they meet in person, it would be unthinkable to go back to trying to kill each other. If diplomacy got nowhere, Richard's new siege equipment had considerably more effect. While King Philip, on the job for 2 months, had blistered Acre's walls with his own archers and siege machines, Richard now had some 300 catapults and ballistas, essentially giant crossbows, hammering Acre's northern perimeter around the clock. Sappers tunneled toward the city's towers, weakening them by burning timbers at their bases, while a crusader version of kamikazes were hired to pry stones by hand out of those formidable walls. The mercenaries, potential suicides every one, were drawn to trade their lives for bits of rock by Richard offering first one, then two, then 4 gold pieces a day for their services. If they were going to die, which they probably would, at least they'd die well off. Infantry occasionally mounted attacks on Acre's gates, but the key sound of the siege now was the unending thunder of massive rocks smashing into massive stone walls, followed by weighty showers of debris plummeting into the dry moat around the city. There was no rest for the defenders. The effect of hundreds of siege machines incessantly pounding their city was dreadful. No one had endured anything like it before, since many of these weapons had never existed. Certainly not in such numbers. For the past 2 horrid years filled with fear, stress, starvation, exhaustion, everyone in Acre had at least been steadied by the security of their magnificent walls, could lose themselves for a while in remote neighborhoods away from the shelling. Now, to see those walls buckling under the relentless assault was to lose faith that anything could survive, that any of their insane struggle made sense. People and mortar both were cracking. Saladin, who didn't have the forces to do more than pick at the edges of the Crusader lines, reportedly rode to a hilltop and wept aloud as he looked toward Acre and saw the torment she was in, overcome by desolate grief. Yet still, Acre held on and held on. After a month of this terrific strain, several portions of Acre's walls so damaged they were close to collapse, the Europeans were ready to storm the weakened city. Saladin's troops made a diversionary attack along the Crusaders' eastern lines, but the intended distraction got nowhere. Richard's sappers, working underground, succeeded in bringing down part of the cursed tower on Acre's northeast face, despite terrible hand-to-hand fighting in tight, dark tunnels with Muslim counter-sappers coming the other way. The final battle to conquer the city started where the tower collapsed amidst the dust-smeared wreckage of its ancient stones. Richard was still sick, but he had himself carried to the front with his crossbow set in his hands. His siege machines were hammering through sections of wall, opening gaps where 1,000 men fought one another face to face, one side frantically trying to break through, the other madly trying to drive their enemies back. Arrows, lances, swords, crossbow bolts, catapult rocks, exploding mines, Greek fire, ordinary fire, knives, rubble itself, everything was thrown into the maelstrom. Even the heavens took notice. The Virgin Mary showed herself to crusaders at the cursed tower, assuring them that God would give them victory in 4 days. Saracens cheered as 1,000 holy martyrs arrived from paradise, on horses of supernatural power, and threw themselves against Islam's enemies. Mere humans did superhuman things. One crusader knight famously kept fighting, even as he was torn to bits by more than 50 arrows. It took a bottle of Greek fire to kill him. There's a legend that a woman archer wrapped in a green cape fought alongside the crusaders until she died, although there's also a less inspiring story that 3 of Acre's governors decided discretion was the better part of valor, jumped into an available boat, and left the crumbling mess of a city behind. A veteran writing about a later encounter gave a sense of what it must have been like when he said he endured so many wounds he couldn't tolerate the weight of his armor the next day. The Saracens fought with the ferocity of desperation, but they were vastly outnumbered and outgunned. On July 12, 1191, little more than a month after Richard Lionheart stepped onto the sands of Acre's Beach, the great siege that had lasted for 2 eternal years was over. Acre had finally been pounded to its knees. It surrendered, agreeing to onerous peace terms that Saladin may have only learned after the fact. After the riotous days and months just passed, peace smoothed its way through the city streets like a blanket of snow. Starved to the point they could scarcely walk, with matted hair, sunken eyes, bruised skin stretched tight over their bones, Antioch survivors, suddenly freed of the perpetual noise, the perpetual threat of injury and death, were as bewildered as returning time travelers. orders had gone out among the Crusaders to leave the city's Muslims in peace. As they wandered along the broken walls looking for loved ones last seen in the middle of frantic fighting. Last seen in a house where the smoking roof was now caved in. Last seen on a street buried under rubble. The Crusaders were truly struck by these people they had finally conquered. One chronicler described them as amazing in their grace and dignity, seeming victorious in their spirited appearance. Feverishly hated just hours ago, survivors were now lauded by Europeans as men of, quote, admirable prowess and exceptional resolute valor. These same men, so resolute in public, may well have faltered in private as they added up their monumental losses. Male inhabitants of the city were to be forcibly baptized as Christians. The tattered city itself went to the Crusaders. Saladin's Acre fleet, 70 ships bottled up for the duration of the siege, was in European hands. Women and children were allowed to go largely unmolested. But the garrison still left in the defeated city, some 3,000 men, were hostages ensuring Saladin's payment of 414,000 pieces of gold, with Richard and Philip each receiving 200,000, while Conrad of Montferrat, the actual negotiator, was to be paid the 14,000 piece balance. Nearly 2,000 European captives held by the Saracens were to be released, and the true cross, taken at Hattin, was to be returned. Half the gold, all the European captives, and the great relic were due in Richard's hands in a month. As for Saladin, he was badly scarred by what happened at Acre. He had devoted the better part of 2 years to the city's rescue. He had failed. Acre, the great Muslim port on the Mediterranean, was lost. Thousands of its people dead and injured. Thousands more held hostage. Saladin's fleet captured. Immense treasure taken. He had been known throughout his brilliant career as the defender, the invincible leader, a reputation essential to his ability to recruit troops and attract financial support from all corners of the Arab world. That reputation, the product of a lifetime of battles, of thousands of decisions, of decades of calculated risk, was chilled and shrunken. With all other options gone, he pulled back, leaving shattered Acre to the Christians. It seems impossible, but the city did not die. It went on, slowly recovering itself. Today, it's an Israeli city, known for manufacturing modern things like chemicals and steel. And there is a footnote. On July 12, 2008, a day which few in the West would take any note of, there was a report that Al Jazeera, the Arabic news network, ran a recurring 5-minute piece lamenting the loss of Acre. In the Muslim world, 8 centuries had scarcely tempered the bite of that terrible summer's day, the day the Great Walls fell. As the dead were buried and losses tallied on both sides, Richard waited in Acre for Saladin to honor the promises that had been made in the Arab leader's name. For Lionheart, the victory was a once-in-a-generation success. In addition to the fortunes he had already taken from Cyprus and Sicily, Richard had won a priceless boost to European morale, the return of the True Cross, the freedom of thousands of European captives, and the possession of a great Mediterranean port that could work in concert with Tyre and Cyprus to support continuing European power in the Outremer. He had captured Saladin's Egyptian fleet, more than 70 ships helplessly trapped for a year in Acre's harbor. And he had due a new fortune in Muslim gold from Saladin himself. His snarling lion's insignia commanded half the known world, from Ireland and Scotland to Cyprus and Syria. Above all, Acre had secured his place in history. This victory had, in fact, taken 2 eternal years of epic struggle. But whatever happened before Richard's arrival on Acre's Beach was forgotten. He was at the very summit of his life on this earth. Acre's survivors probably had little interest in Richard Lionheart's glory. They had to start in on the grim work of clearing corpses amid shattered rubble throughout the city, so that walls, towers, markets, homes, and streets could be rebuilt. The Europeans turned their hands to a multitude of their own labors. Worn crossbows were squared. Blacksmiths hammered dents out of iron breastplates. Siege equipment was greased and repaired. Relieved of chronic stress after the past months and years, crusaders variously prayed, whored, drank, dozed in the brilliant sunlight, learned to balance on crutches they'd never again be without. Richard's sentries scanned the desert from Acre's remaining watchtowers, alert for Saladin's convoy, the strings of pack horses and camels that would come loaded with ransom gold. Perhaps the newlyweds, Richard and Berengaria, had some moments together, walking atop the walls that had been pursued with such intensity for so long, watching as chipped stones were reset in Acre's blasted face. New wife or no, Richard's key focus was on his stunning rights to several breathtaking fortunes. True, he and Philip Augustus had agreed back in France to split the spoils of war. But Richard's view of what that meant didn't square with Philip's. Was it enough, as Philip maintained, to have simply signed their agreement, or, as Richard insisted, must a share be earned with a sword? The two kings argued heatedly over Cyprus, Philip demanding half the territory and half the extortionate tax revenue Richard was enjoying. Richard, who had done all the work on that craggy island, refused. If Philip came up short, even less was left for the Crusaders, many of whom had weathered 2 horrific years, 2 indescribable winters of siege warfare, not a mere month. Yet it was Richard's men who commandeered local homes for living quarters in Acre, while crusaders from other countries were barred from even setting foot in the city without Plantagenet permission. Scofflaws risked having the offending foot chopped off. 13 foolhardy crusaders were subsequently seen hobbling through camp, stumps wrapped in bloody rags. One memorable afternoon, a moment Richard would later have both time and reason to regret, he let his men pull down a banner belonging to Duke Leopold of Austria. Some reports claimed they added insult to injury by trampling it under their horses. The highly aristocratic duke, who had taken command of German forces after Frederick of Swabia died during the siege, had simply been trying to stake out territory of his own in the city he had helped win. Unfortunately for the duke, the weakened Germans had little but a secondary role at Acre, and neither Richard nor Philip Augustus had any interest in sharing the riches won in the siege with this minor player. Any claim of Leopold's would never survive, and even Leopold probably guessed as much. But the manner of its dismissal was insulting, a public affront compounded by Richard's disdainful failure to apologize. For his part, Leopold would turn out to be a proud man possessed of a long memory. He left the crusade furious at Richard's arrogance, an opinion he and his men would freely share all along their 2,000-mile route home. The French were no happier. Brimming with ego in the wake of Acre's collapse, Richard apparently believed that his cavalier treatment of his French ally since the day they left Vézelay would be swallowed whole. One has to say that the Plantagenet ability to disregard people who had helped make the family fortunes is one aspect of their psyche that will forever fascinate. Philip Augustus had been one of Richard's most valuable supporters back when Henry Plantagenet still ruled, pressing the old king hard more than once to recognize Richard as his heir. Richard had even sworn personal fealty to Philip. But now, immeasurably wealthier, with an unmatched military reputation, Richard was treating his fellow king as if Philip were Richard's vassal rather than the other way around. Lionheart proposed that Philip Augustus sign a pledge that both kings would stay in the Latin East for 3 years, or until Holy Jerusalem was retaken. Philip, of course, had sworn a vow before leaving France to fight to free the Holy Land. But if Richard truly thought the French king was interested in spending more time in his boisterous presence, he was mistaken. Within days of Acre's fall, Philip announced that he considered his crusader's vow fulfilled and was going back to France. It isn't all that hard to think of reasons he might want to be on his way. Like many, Philip had been ill off and on for months, a risk for his entire country. A widower with a solitary 3-year-old son, he also needed a new wife. Then, too, Philip of Flanders had died during the siege without an heir, spurring the French king to get home to mastermind the Flemish succession before the Plantagenets took a shot at it. Nor did the king of France delight in being reduced to a mere shadow tethered to Richard's side, especially when his anticipated 50% of the winnings was turning out to be considerably less. In short, Philip's decision to go made sense, but rumors instantly swept the crusaders' ranks. Philip was dying. His toddler son back in Paris was dying. The man wasn't brave or tough enough to take more fighting. It's true that Philip was not considered the bravest of knights, or even a particularly adept rider. Supposedly the only horse he could control was the one kept in readiness to carry him away from a battlefield. Given that most French crusaders stayed behind when their king went home, Philip's departure was roundly criticized then and ever since as petulant, selfish, and short-sighted, even cowardly. At best, nothing but a weak slap at vastly annoying Richard. To be fair to the man, it was certainly true that Philip was no Lionheart. Yet he had spent 3 years of his life grappling with this crusade. He had taken on the dangers of the final Acre campaign before Richard reached Acre's Beach. He was due a handsome share of the Acre ransom. The city had been won. Enough was enough. He was going home, where he could enjoy both the pleasure of escaping Richard and the side benefit of opportunities to probe around the edges of the Plantagenet world, while its king was off in Syria. Philip wouldn't be the only one smiling at the thought of waving goodbye. Richard now had the field entirely to himself, with no co-commander to consult, no one he could conceivably be obliged to share plunder with. The man who once grandly said, "I rule, no one rules me," probably couldn't have been happier. Given the ethics of crusading, he gained Philip's departing oath to maintain peace with the Plantagenets, so long as Richard was on crusade, with an additional chivalrous pledge of 40 days' due warning that hostilities would recommence once the English king was again in residence. Given the history of Capetian pledges to the Plantagenets, and vice versa, it wasn't much, but it was something. Yet before Philip left, the two were obliged to deal with one another on a crucial matter between the English and the French. Who was to be the next king of Jerusalem once the victors of Acre swept into that country? There was an old agreement that the kings of England and France, along with the Holy Roman Emperor and the Pope, would be responsible for choosing the King of Jerusalem if no clear heir existed. The irresistible opportunity for a European king to control that prized crown had finally arrived. The situation was delightfully complicated, filled with multiple opportunities for settling old scores. As we know, the leper king, Baldwin IV, had died childless. His one sibling, Sibylla, was the dynastic successor, but Baldwin's distaste for her choice of husband, Guy of Lusignan, blotted her chances. Baldwin opted for her son instead, only for the fates to sweep in. Not only did Baldwin die soon thereafter, but the little boy died too. Jerusalem's governing council took hold of itself and told Sibylla she could have Guy or she could have the throne, but she could not have both. Clever Sibylla agreed to divorce Guy, with the proviso that she could choose her next husband herself. Once the scepter was in her hands, she thumbed her nose at the governing council by immediately remarrying her ex-husband and crowning him King of Jerusalem with her own hands. Whatever else might be said of the couple, they clearly brought passion to their union. To everyone's shock and Guy's sorrow, Sibylla died in the summer of 1190, in one of the pestilential fevers that swept through Acre Camp. Her little girls died with her. While Guy survived, he was still best known as the man who had lost Hattin, then Jerusalem itself. His wobbly march to the throne was now based on little more than being Sibylla's widower, placed on the throne by luck and cunning rather than acclaim. And he faced a far more attractive rival, Conrad of Montferrat, the prodigious hero of Tyre. We've come to the end of our story for the time being. I am Beckett Arnold, narrating from the book Lion's Forge, adapted for us by the author Karen Markle Knapp. Thank you to Francis Butt for voicing our introduction and so much more. If you like what you hear, please give us a rating, follow our channel, and share us with your friends. Most importantly, please join us again December 30th. For the next episode of Lion's Forge, available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts, including on YouTube with video episode trailers. Visit us on Facebook, where you can ask questions, leave reviews, and interact with me. Until next time, thank you for listening.